What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to episode 126 of Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns, a Massive Breakdown podcast. We're coming to you on a fantastic Sunday morning. Going to be continuing our chronological Clone Wars watch through. This is going to be a short episode. We've only got the one episode to talk about. It is Senate Spy. Very excited to talk about this. I could not, for the life of me, remember pretty much anything about this episode other than the character Clovis. I watched it and had very low expectations because the opening was, you know, all this romance and spycraft, and I wasn't super into it, but the ending really turned the episode around for me, and I actually ended up quite enjoying it. And then you and I were talking about this. I was reading the behind the scenes stuff on the episode, and I was kind of surprised by how it ended. Well, it turns out it's pretty much like a shot for shot remake of an Alfred Hitchcock movie called Notorious from 1946. And so when you do that, the twists and turns that I wouldn't really have expected from a Clone Wars episode kind of make a little bit more sense. So we're going to be talking about that, but first, let's get the introductions out of the way. As always, I'm your host, Mercules, joined today by Kit Kutcha. And how are you doing today, Kit?
Oh, I'm doing pretty darn well. Kind of looking forward to digging into this. I didn't know that this was based on a Hitchcock movie until you told me like 20 minutes ago, so... I'm really curious to hear a little bit more about that as we talk about the episode. And this whole kind of arc, the story arc in Clone Wars that this kicks off, is a really fun one. It's got a lot of twists and turns, ups and downs, kind of takes us all over the place. In some ways it's essentially like the first episode of what is more or less a 5-episode arc in Clone Wars, if you want to look at it that way, where everything is really directly interconnected. And that's kind of not something that happens very often. So I'm glad we get to spend some time really digging into it. And yeah.
So, oh, because, wow, I literally never made the connection that
the droid factory,
weapons factory from this episode is the droid factory that they go to attack in the next episode.
Yeah,
I literally did not make that connection until you just said it. I was thinking, I was like, what other episodes is this one connected to? I know that there's a Clovis arc like later on in the series, but I was like, what are we talking about here? Oh wow, that's just like the whole world just opened up to me right there.
Yeah, it's 5 episodes is way too many to do in one. I guess I didn't realize last week when we talked about it that you hadn't put together that they were connected. I just assumed you're like, well, this one's very separate and very different from the other ones, so it makes sense to do it alone.
I didn't remember what I literally remembered nothing about this episode. Like last week when I read about it, I was like, oh yeah, Clovis. Like I remember Clovis the character, and I remember there's some sort of like Anakin doesn't like Clovis, he's jealous of him, there's some sort of weird love triangle with them or whatever. I remember that.
Yeah.
But I didn't remember that the Nemoidians were dealing with it. I didn't remember that there was a weapons factory. Like, I didn't remember that the Geonosians were involved. I literally didn't remember any of that at all. I don't know if it's because, like, to me, this episode, when I watched it the first time, like, obviously, I've watched this episode. This is probably the third time I've watched this episode now. And I've never made the connection that it was, like, linked to the following episodes. So that's kind of interesting for me. But yeah, I mean, when I was talking about it, I literally thought it was a perfectly standalone episode. I didn't think that there was any connection at all. But it really is kind of a standalone episode. Like, even though the weapons factory is what they're targeting because of the intelligence they gather here, like, the episode itself is pretty self-contained.
It really is. And it's a very unique episode as well. I don't know if it's the only episode where this is true, but it's certainly the first episode where this is true, that in the whole episode, nobody fires a blaster, nobody ignites a lightsaber, and nothing explodes, which really makes it stand out from its fellow Clone Wars adventures. I also feel like this episode kind of does a lot to ground the Anakin of the Clone Wars animated series in the Anakin that we get in the live-action films. We get some of that creepy possessiveness leaking through, you know, that he can barely contain himself from violence throughout this episode. And, it sort of sparks, you know, this distrust of Padme in him that we don't otherwise see very often in the animated series, but that does obviously, you know, bear fruit and during Anakin's downfall films. It's a very interesting episode for lots of reasons. And the fact that it's based on a Hitchcock film actually kind of makes sense why they were able to pull this type of episode off, because I feel like, mm-hmm. you know, based on the typical Star Wars, Clone Wars writing, trying to do an episode that is, you know, completely nonviolent, all about intrigue and relationships and a love triangle, like, it's not the kind of thing that they typically even attempt, much less pull mm-hmm. off. But they did it here, and it works, and at no point does it feel, you know, incorrect for things to happen the way that they do. Even the twists and turns, you know, you mentioned the ending of the episode is kind of a surprise, right? It doesn't necessarily go down the way that you expect it to based on the rest of Clone Wars.
Yeah. I mean, I was totally surprised by the episode. I mean, it opens up not the strongest ever. It opens up very typically for what I would have expected right. from a Clone Wars episode dealing with this material.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't, you know, for the first 10 or 15 minutes, I wasn't super enthused about it. But one thing that it did, you know, hammer home for me is, as George has said this a bunch, you know, about the Jedi and love and things like that. And he's like, no, the Jedi can love. They are welcome to love. They are encouraged to love. What is supposed to be forbidden is possession. And that's where Anakin is wrong. And you can tell all these early Clone Wars story arcs have, like, George's hand a lot more heavily on them. And this is one of those ones where it really felt like he was trying to drive that home. That, like, this is what Anakin is doing wrong. He's possessive. And because he's possessive, he's jealous. And because he's jealous, he's angry. And because, you know, of all these things, he's fearful of losing Padme.
Right.
Even though there's no real reason he should ever be concerned about losing Padme to this guy Clovis, right? Like, he shouldn't care about that. So it kind of is interesting, like, how nicely the Hitchcock story mirrored what they needed for Anakin in this situation. And it worked out really perfectly. And yeah, it drives home the possession that Anakin feels over Padme, which is wrong. And that's the thing that Lucas has been talking about for years and years and years, is like, no, it's okay for them to love. Like, Anakin loving Padme is fine. Anakin believing that he needs to control her and that he needs to, you know, basically, I hesitate to say own her, right? But, like, he doesn't want her to do this, and he tells her she can't do this. And that, of course, makes her want to do it, and that upsets him. And, you know, that's pretty much, luckily for them, exactly how the Hitchcock story worked, too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it plays perfectly to his character. And, yeah, I mean, it all just kind of lines up in a way that it makes so much sense for the characters to behave the way that they do, that I would never have guessed that they were drawing almost, you know, in some scenes, you know, it could be almost line for line, shot for shot, you know, mm-hmm. a completely different story. Well, maybe let's come back at the end and we can talk a little bit about the Hitchcock film. Neither of us, I don't think, has actually seen it, but you've at least read a plot summary. No. So.
Yeah, I read the Wikipedia on it because I was curious after I saw this. I was like, oh, I've never heard of that. It's got, Clark Grant in it and Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant, there we go. Cary Grant, Ingrid Bergman, and Claude Rains. And yeah, I mean, supposedly it's considered a great Hitchcock film. They said that it was a step into maturity for him as a filmmaker when he made this. And it was his first attempt at doing like an epic romance drama, which he hadn't done before. And, you know, it made $24 million in 1946. So clearly it was extremely well received.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, so back to Sentence By. Oh, first, housekeeping.
Yes.
We're getting that out of the way. We've got, you know, no new patrons to thank, no new reviews to read. So just as a reminder, if you guys want to support the show, those are the two things that you can do besides listening that help support the show the most, is leave us a 5-star review on either Spotify or Apple Podcast, and we'll read it out and give you a personal thank you. Or you can pledge to our patron, you know, the lowest tiers. Pretty cheap, $2, and you still get some pretty cool stuff. You get access to our Discord where we chat a lot about Star Wars. And if you pledge at the higher tiers, you can get some neat stickers or posters or cool t-shirts with art by a couple of artists who've helped out on the podcast in the past. But to the actual show itself, Anakin has returned from war, basically from a lengthy tour of duty, is how, what they call it. And he's finally got some time to spend with Padme, or so he thinks. So he brings some takeout to her house, and I think it's actually sushi.
It is.
Is what the Ourobesh says.
Yeah,
is it also warm sushi?
Yeah. So this is a unique Star Wars delicacy, warm sushi. Must be a Tatooinean thing.
Yeah, I would think so. He unfortunately doesn't get to spend as much time with her as he would like. The Jedi have been trying to summon him for quite a while, and Obi-Wan, you know, mentions he doesn't really know where he is, although I'm sure Obi-Wan suspects where he is. But he finally, you know, acknowledges the pinging of the Jedi Council and has to return to the temple. And Padme is not very happy with him going back, but he's like, you know, duty comes first, especially in wartime, is I think what he actually says to her.
Yeah. Words that he will regret.
Mm-hmm.
So he does, he goes before the council, and this, I appreciate this because this kind of echoes something else that happens in the films, right? We get, you know, talking about the parallels between what happens in Senate Spy and what happens in the films. This is chronologically the first time that the Jedi Council is asking Anakin to help them spy on, you know, the Senate. Later, they want him to spy on the Chancellor, and now they want him to help them convince Padme to spy on a fellow senator. And he is not super on board with this. You know, it's not quite the same as them asking him to spy on someone he considers a friend, but it is definitely putting him in a spot that he does not appreciate being in. And he tells them outright, like, Padme's not going to be on board with this. She's not going to want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, they say, well, look, Senator Rush, we believe he is helping the separatists. He's a spy and a traitor. But we cannot take, you know, official Jedi action against him. We cannot have a Jedi involved in spying on him directly. Because, you know, if we're wrong, it, you know, puts us in a bad light.
Right.
You know, and it's the Jedi Council is in this position where they're having to do these actions that are just so far removed from kind of the normal scope of what the Jedi do. Spying on the Galactic Senate is just not kind of the normal Jedi way, so to speak, but it's the position that they're in here. And so they need Padme, and Anakin learns that Padme and Clovis used to be pretty close. So they insist on him talking to her because they know that she trusts him, right? They know that he has a close relationship with her. And I think this is where what you said earlier about, you know, kind of what George had said about the Jedi being able to have those close personal relationships and that being okay, the people kind of misunderstanding that, that comes into play here, because it's clear that, like, they're not blind. Obviously, Anakin cares a great deal about Padme. They all know that. None of them care, except that it's useful to them. Right? Even Obi-Wan isn't concerned about it. Right, and he's the closest to Anakin. And throughout the Clone Wars, we see Obi-Wan, you know, is kind of aware that Anakin's relationship with Padme is probably too close. But he never really does anything about it. And he doesn't mm-hmm. say anything here. You know, we get a raised eyebrow when Anakin,
right,
you know, is maybe a little too aggressive or a little too upset that Padme was close to Clovis previously. The implication that she had a more than professional relationship with him. But that's the full extent of it. And the rest of the Jedi are just like, well, why would you have known that?
You know, and there's that one really good deleted scene from Revenge of the Sith where Obi-Wan kind of openly tells Padme, not even kind of, just flat out tells her. He's like, he has always known.
Yeah.
He's like, I've always known, like, I sensed in the Force for Anakin's sake. I pretend like I don't. But, of course, I've known this entire time. And, you know, I think that's the raised eyebrow that we get here. It's a shame that that scene was deleted from Revenge of the Sith.
It adds so much.
Yeah. It was a weird choice to get rid of that scene because it is arguably could have been one of the best scenes in the movie. But they removed it, and it's a shame. I think in my head I still treat it like it's canon. And I let that influence kind of a little bit of the way that I look at the character and the relationship that Anakin and Obi-Wan have. Because, you know, especially in like the Bad Batch arc in season 7, right, where, you know, Anakin's talking to Padme on the holo, you know, projector or whatever it is, and Obi-Wan says something about like, oh, tell Padme I said hello, right?
Yeah.
And it's like at that point in time, like he just knows for sure. So I think even here he probably knows to a certain extent. But
yeah.
Let's see. So anyways, she's supposed to be spying on Baron Rush Clovis. Now the interesting thing is that originally, very, very early on in production, this was supposed to be the character Paulo that we hear about in Attack of the Clones, who she talks about, you know, having a crush on. But obviously that doesn't work in terms of the chronological nature of the show. That was when, you know, she was 12 years old. Paulo explicitly like left politics to become an artist. So it wouldn't really have made sense for him to come back. So they just created a new character for it, which is Baron Rush Clovis. They supposedly, you know, had a brief fling when they were both doing their Senate orientation as new senators, you know, before she, I guess not technically before she met Anakin, before she met the adult Anakin.
Right.
Right. Rush Clovis is interesting. He comes back for a 3-episode arc later on. I think in season 6, actually, he comes back for a 3-episode arc where he gets like elected to be the head of the banking clan. But there's an arc in season 4, I believe, with Lux Bonteri, if you recall, which is the one where Lux Bonteri wants to get revenge for his mother's murder. Mm-hmm. And so he goes to try to join Death Watch with Ahsoka.
Yeah.
And supposedly that was actually the first episode of what was a 4-episode arc that was going to conclude with the last like Clovis arc. And for some reason or another, they broke that out and they put Just a Friend in Need in season 4. And then the Clovis stuff got pushed to season 5, and then it got pushed from season 5 to season 6. So it never even originally aired before the show got canceled until they did the like lost episodes thing and brought it back for season 6. So it's kind of interesting. So he's not, you know, he is a character that we see again. He does have some importance, but we don't see him again for quite some time. It's going to be at least, you know, 2 seasons before we even get another mention of him.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's fine, right? With the way that this episode plays out, there's really no indication that we will ever hear from him again. And so him coming back later is just kind of a nice treat, right? A nice little callback, like, oh, yeah, you remember Clovis.
He didn't get murdered by the Nemordians at the end of this episode, like it's kind of implied.
Yeah. They just had a nice talk. So, you know, anyways, so where are we here? You know, Yoda has insisted that Anakin, you know, be the one to talk to Padme. She's already told Yoda no. And so we pick up the next day in the Senate building. Anakin finds Padme, who is still mad at him. And, you know, for those of us who are in relationships, this feels very familiar when you have made plans with your special someone and then you blow them off for work after promising that you wouldn't.
Yep.
Definitely not over it the next day. So, you know, he asks her about her, you know, about Rush Clovis, and she's like, look, I already told Yoda no. I'm not going to spy on him. He's a colleague. You know, he's an old friend. And so there's, you know, the summary on Wikipedia does not do this conversation justice in the slightest. Because Padme is very much like, just like, absolutely not. And like, you know, how can you even ask me to do this? And she's, you know, clearly still pissed off with Anakin for ditching her last night. And Anakin is like, how well do you know Rush, right? He's like super jealous.
Yep.
Like absolute like high school jealous, freaking out. You know, like how well do you know this guy? Which I think only makes Padme angrier that he's being jealous after, especially after he, you know, was supposed to spend a romantic evening with her and then left. And so then he's like, well, I'm, you know, I'm glad you don't want to do it. In fact, I forbid you from doing it. And his jealousy and him telling her that he doesn't want her to do it, that he, you know, forbids her from doing it, this just infuriates her. She's now like, oh, you don't think I could do this. You don't think I'm capable of doing this. And this is, there's something about this fight that to me shows why they work as a couple. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Anakin is Anakin, right? He is overbearing. He just steamrolls people constantly. He's just so sometimes overconfident, but just so incredibly confident in himself that it takes somebody with an incredibly strong personality to stand up to him and to rein him in. And Padme just does that so easily. She's just like, excuse me, you're not telling me what to do. I decide what mm-hmm. to do. And the Jedi think that Rush is a separatist sympathizer. Then as his friend, I have to be the one to go and prove his innocence. And how dare you tell mm-hmm. me that I can't? You don't get to decide that. And she shuts Anakin down so hard. He is just left like completely fuming and helpless. Like, well, fine, then I'm going with you. And suddenly it goes from him, you know, just absolutely not wanting her to do this, that now he suddenly is like going with her. Good. And he doesn't even know how he got there. So this, I think some people could be annoyed by this. You know, it's a lot of people I think are put off by spending too much time on Anakin and Padme's relationship. But I really appreciate this scene because it actually makes them more convincing to me as a real couple. Seeing mm-hmm. them fight and seeing the fight go down in a way that is very believable, where it's not entirely clear that, like, it's one of those fights where, like, they're sort of both making mistakes and it feels very human on both sides. I don't know what it is, but there's just something about it that, for me, like, it cements the relationship in a way that hasn't been done in the animated series to this point. You get that from it, or is that just totally in my head?
No. I mean, I think it does. I'm more ambivalent about it, I think. I have never particularly loved the Anakin Padme like relationship, mostly because I think the foundation it's built on in Attack of the Clones is kind of one of the weaker things that comes out of the prequels.
Fair.
However, I do believe that stuff in the Clone Wars, and in particular episodes like this, like builds a framework upon which the relationship can lay that is significantly more solid than anything that we got in Attack of the Clones.
Absolutely.
So I do appreciate that. However, I'm still just kind of generally ambivalent about the relationship as a whole. So I'm like, I'm glad that you're improving it, but also I could kind of just like, you know, I could take it or leave it. But yeah, I mean, it is more realistic between the two of them. Like in Attack of the Clones, they're kind of depicted as like argue, don't like each other, lovers married. And it's like, whoa, hold on. I feel like there was some stuff in between there that like should have happened. And this does a much better job of, like you said, making them believable and showing them like, yeah, they do love each other very, very much, but they also have their issues because they're, you know, they're young and like they're still somewhat immature, even though she's a senator and she was a queen. Like, she's not above being kind of put off by Anakin saying something and doing something to get back at him.
Right.
Right. And Anakin has never been able to control his jealousy and certainly can't control it here. So the part that I appreciated the most of this was Anakin's plan just like totally backfiring, where he's like, well, you already said you're not going to spy on him, so this works out great for me.
Yeah.
And then that basically, like, him actually trying not to convince her to do it convinces her to do it, which I thought was pretty funny. So,
yeah, it's. some of the best writing for their relationship to this point. So,
yeah,
you know, that's really all I'm getting at here. I'm not saying it's a masterpiece of romantic, you know, screenplay, but it is better than what we've had in the past.
Yeah. So if you do want to know anything about Clovis's backstory, you know, she talks to the Jedi Council. She acknowledges that she's going to do it. She kind of points out that, you know, we were close in the past, but he wanted to take the relationship to the next level. I wanted to stay professional. He took it very hard. If you are interested in that, in the backstory to that relationship, the canon novel Queen's Shadow actually details that part of the relationship. He's, I wouldn't say a major character in that novel, but he is a present character in that novel that has a pretty decent part of the storyline going on in that. And actually, Queen Shadow has a pretty cool cover too. It's by E.K. Johnston. I want to say that E.K. Johnston's also the one that wrote the Ahsoka novel.
Oh, okay.
As well, yeah. So also pretty good. And she's done a couple of contributions from A Certain Point of View, which is the anthology that they did for one of the anniversaries of Star Wars. So we're not going to talk too much about that here, but, you know, she meets with Clovis at a restaurant. You know, he luckily for her, tells her that he's going to Cato Nemoidia to put the fear of Scipio back into the Trade Federation. You know, he says they love taking out loans from the banking clan, but they don't love paying him back.
Right.
And he's like, you know, she mentioned something about like, oh, I've been trying to, you know, get some trade acquiescence from the Trade Federation for a long time. He's like, oh, well, you can just come with me. And it's like, wow, you could not have played that more perfectly, Padme. Congratulations, that worked out very nicely. So, you know, he's like, you can come along. She's like, oh, for political reasons or personal reasons? He's like, I hope a little bit of both, but more personal than anything else. So she's playing the role well. Anakin pretends to be the pilot of the ship so that he can get to go with her.
Yeah.
And we actually get a speaking line from Captain Typho, which he's for some reason not in the credits, nor is his voice actor in the credits. So I wondered if they just like took his line from something else, like a pre-recorded line, and just put it in here, because he doesn't talk very much, nor does he show up very much.
See, I would think they would still have to credit him, so it is weird, you know, exactly. Yeah. If it was just some kind of slip up or goof, or if there's, you know, if you're reusing a line, you don't have to credit them. That doesn't seem right. But.
Right. As they go to take off, man, Anakin just being about as petulant as they come, but he breaks one of the like restraints so that Clovis can't sit next to Padme. And then when they're flying off, he's spying on them with a camera, and he sees, you know, Clovis try to get close to her, and he jerks the ship so that Clovis flies across the cargo bay and then falls back into a different seat that's further away from Padme.
Yeah.
And he's quite pleased with his work there. They arrive at Cato Nemoidia. They're greeted by Senator Lot Dodd, and the featurette for this episode with Dave Filoni leaned quite heavily on explaining the role that the Trade Federation, the Banking Clan, and the Commerce Guild have at this current point in time, which is that they are technically members of the Republic, mm-hmm. which is why they have senators, representatives to the Republic. However, they are officially neutral parties, and they deal with both sides during this conflict. So is it criminal? Yes, kind of. But you also kind of can't, you can't, like, alienate them because you need them. They're too helpful to have, right? So you kind of just have to deal with the banking clan loaning stuff to both sides, the Trade Federation making deals with both sides. But like, I was surprised by how much politics Dave Filoni went into in the featurette. I was really expecting more of the, like, you know, doing the stuff like they talked about Kurosawa with the Seven Samurai with bounty hunters. I was really expecting more of that, but no, they leaned very, very heavily on politics, which kind of mirrors, you know, George Lucas's trade disputes and things like that that he wanted in the prequels. So
really went heavily on explaining how that all worked, and, you know, kind of explaining why they still are members of the Republic. And it's interesting too, there's something a bit dystopian about a corporate entity having a representative in government, right? You know, this is the sort of thing that, you know, whole like downfall of civilization novels are written about, you know, corporations becoming sovereign. You know, you've got all kinds of, you know, and actually, you know, coming out of the 70s and 80s, there is actually a lot of dystopian science fiction about futures in which corporations have, you know, essentially their own sovereign territory and national powers and representation as sort of, you know, governments unto themselves, which...
So like Disney in Florida used to be?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they had their own everything. They were basically their own government and a tract of land that they owned. They provided their own police. They provided their own fire services. They have their own... They basically self-manage this city that they've got that all their parks reside in. And their super creepy town called Celebration, which I don't know if you've ever read anything about that, but Celebration is like an entire town that's like a manufactured town. And it's supposed to be like, if you lived in like Disney World's like hometown America or whatever it is, like if that was a real city, that's what Celebration is like. I don't know if they do it anymore, but we live in Florida. It doesn't snow here, right? Well, they used to have fake snow that would fall out of the light post during like Christmas time. Super, super creepy. Just really uncanny valley, weird place. If you ever have a chance, look it up. It's definitely super spooky, but tons of people live there, so.
Okay, yeah. No canon for taste. But, I mean, that is the sort of weird thing that happens, I think, in, you know, this sort of, like, this corporate dystopia. You know, anyways, without getting too far into it, it struck me during this episode, kind of one of the many areas where, like, gosh, there is a lot of room for probably horrible, horrible things happening in the Star Wars galaxy that are just never directly addressed. But we do get them addressed a little bit here, right? So we've got, Padme being shown to her quarters while Senator Lot Dodd and Clovis discuss the amount of credits needed to build the new supermassive droid foundry with Poggle the Lesser, which is still one of the best character names in Star Wars. Poggle the Lesser being the Archduke of Geonosis and the public leader of the Geonosians during the Clone Wars, although they do, of course, have a hive-minded queen who is virtually never seen, although she does appear in the animated series later. So we'll get to that at some point.
So let's see. So they show up. He tries to send Padme away because he says he has to discuss business with Lot Dodd. Well, obviously the business is the thing that everybody was worried about on the Jedi Council, which is he is in fact working with the Separatists, as we all knew. No surprise to anyone.
They don't drag it out here.
In Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious, what is actually happening is that the female main character, played by Ingrid Bergman, is the daughter of a Nazi, and the guy is a Nazi collaborator down in Brazil or South America or somewhere. And he's working with these Nazis to build weapons. So it is, you know, honestly, they got really lucky here with how well that story translated into what they needed for Star Wars. She, you know, goes up to her room. She comes back down. She kind of like tries to sneak in, but obviously Lot Dodd notices she's there and they hide the hologram of the weapons factory pretty quickly. And, you know, he offers to take her on a walk and stuff like that. And Clovis and her leave, and Lot Dodd and Poggle are just like, wow, he is so unbelievably weak. Like, he doesn't understand that that's obviously a spy. Like, she should not be here. His heart is tricking his head. And so they're like, you know what? That's his weakness, though. Like, he clearly loves her, so let's poison her, and then we'll be able to get what we want. We'll basically be able to get this cheaper, get a better deal, or something like that, right? So,
yeah, he's, he's being very, very hesitant to extend any more credit to them to build another one of these factories, you know, which is understandable, right? It makes sense. And of course, on behalf of the banking clan, he wants to extract the highest possible interest rate from them. So their plan makes sense. You know, meanwhile, we've got Anakin and R2-D2 just kind of hanging out in the ship, waiting for Padme to signal that she has the information that they're there for. Anakin is pretty antsy. You know, it's pretty clear he just wants to rush in with his lightsaber and take the information. But he's being as patient as Anakin ever is. I don't know. I don't want to say to his credit necessarily, because it doesn't feel like he wants to wait at all. But he's exhibiting a little bit of self-control.
Yep. So they go to dinner. Lot Dodd does the thing that all sneaky, slimy poisoners do, where he drinks out of the cup first, but he actually has the poison on his hand. And he, like, you know, under the pretense of wiping off where he drank, like, wipes the poison onto the cup and then offers it to Padme. It is a slow-acting poison. And so they get all the way through dinner. And she kind of gets progressively worse and worse and worse as the night goes on. But she does manage to actually... steal the hologram, which has all the data about the weapons factory on it. She figures out, she tries a bunch of different passcodes, but, you know, I roll my eyes at this a little bit, but of course the passcode is her name, right? So poor Clovis has apparently been madly in love this entire time and is using her name as a passcode for his most secret documents.
Yeah.
Look, you know, he's not following best practice rules for safe passcodes, right? It needs to be more than, you know, it needs to be more than 8 characters. It needs to have letters, numbers, special characters.
Right.
And, you know, ideally a passphrase is better than a password. So
now, I don't know how special characters work in Ouroboros, but certainly the Senate or in this case, the banking clan's IT department is going to be very upset with him.
He could have made it I love Padme #3, right? Or like a #3, right? Because then it makes a little heart. I love Padme. And then she never would have gotten that and we wouldn't be in this situation. But because of his poor password management, here we are.
Here we are. And she would have had to try to get R2-D2 in there to hack it.
Right. Right. Which, of course, you know, probably could have done. But
naturally,
you know, she takes the hologram disc and Rush kind of sneaks up behind her and surprises her. And she throws her arms around him and hugs him. And Anakin walks in just at that time. And you can tell that, like, this is one of the things I was worried about. Maybe it's because I've just watched The Flash on the CW too often. But, like, these misunderstandings that characters get super upset about and, like, wrecks a relationship. That's actually where I was expecting that this was going to go. And I was not looking forward to it. But here's where they start to kind of move away from that. So she shows him the disc that she has. And Anakin realizes what's going on. And that she's just, you know, trying to distract Clovis so that she can get the disc out of there. So he uses the Force, pulls the disc to himself, and leaves. But pretty much as soon as she leaves, I think she collapses, right?
Yeah, it moves along quickly there at that point. And so, you know, Clovis, of course, goes into, you know, a bit of a panic. He's very concerned. And he takes her and puts her in a bed. And I believe he actually summons a medical droid first and then goes to talk to Lot Dodd and tell her that, you know, Padme has collapsed. And it's at this point that Lot Dodd then, you know, basically comes clean. He's like, yep, we poisoned her because she's obviously a spy. And, you know, Clovis is pretty upset. He doesn't believe Lot, but he is convinced when he finds the data disk with the plans for the droid factory missing. And he goes to confront Padme, who, you know, has been under the treatment of the medical droid, is, you know, conscious again, if not necessarily recovered. I think there's still, you know, at this point, she's not been cured of the poison. The droid has just kind of staved off the worst of the effects. So he confronts her, says she, you know, she betrayed him. And she's like, you betrayed the Republic. I didn't want to believe it was true. He's like, well, where's the data disk? She tells him that it's already on its way to the Senate, which, as it turns out, is not quite true. Because Anakin at this point enters the room and, you know, tells Clovis to get away from her. realizes, you know, that she's been poisoned, and there's a brief kind of tense moment here where I think that Anakin is about to like pull his lightsaber on Clovis and start threatening him, but it doesn't happen. And Clovis realizes that, you know, he really does care about Padme. He wants to save her life. Says, look, Lot Dad wouldn't have used a poison that he didn't have the antidote for. If you give me the disc, I can trade it to him for the poison or for the antidote. And, so they start to carry Padme back to the ship, but they run into Lot Dad and his Betty droids and his other assistants.
Yeah, those Betty droids are pretty kind of like weirdly creepy. They're like these very feminine gold droids, which I didn't know that they had a specific designation, but yeah, they're called Betty droids. So I guess if you see those again, you'll know what they are.
Yeah. Not really clear exactly what makes them distinct from any other type of droid, but I guess, you know, the Nemoidians like them. So, they're like, you know, we're gonna take her back to Coruscant, but Lot Dad's like, oh, you're not going anywhere. And at this point, Clovis is had enough, and he pulls a blaster on Lot Dad. How Lot Dad didn't see this coming, don't know. I guess he thought he had Clovis pegged. He's like, we've got her poisoned. He's not gonna try anything. He was just incredibly wrong about Clovis's character. And Clovis forces him to give up the antidote, which they give to Padme, and they run away. Anakin gets Padme onto the ship along with did both 3PO and R2-D2 go with him? I forget now if they were both. Yep.
Yeah, they did.
Like, they're both in that final scene. On board with the ship, you know, Clovis is kind of covering their escape with his blaster. And Anakin's had, I think he's had R2-D2 start the ship, and they just take off. And Anakin just leaves him there to talk to Lot Dad.
Talk in air quotes.
Yeah.
He's got a good closing line. I think he says, I have confidence in your survival skills.
Yeah, he does. He does.
Is what he says to him. It just leaves him there. So
it's don't worry, Clovis. It's good to know you have a heart. I wish I could give you the disc, but I have a lot of faith in your survival skills.
Yep.
Yeah. And thus,
this is a pretty good scene.
Anakin eliminates a romantic rival and accomplishes his mission in one fell swoop.
It's nice to see them succeed. They got what they were coming for. They saved Padme. You know, C-3PO got a ton of speaking lines in this, which is great.
He did.
Always good to hear Anthony Daniels. The last like couple minutes of the episode, it didn't end how I was expecting. I think from the point where Anakin walked in on her hugging Clovis is where like it kind of upended my expectations for where the episode was going to go. And I thought it finished pretty strong. Now, of course, it does that because it's based, you know, pretty tightly off of a Hitchcock thing. And, you know, Hitchcock's a master storyteller, so that kind of makes sense. But, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery.
It is.
So I got to say, it works really, really well. I would have just been super impressed with this episode had I not known that it was a Hitchcock thing. But even now that I know it's a Hitchcock thing, still super impressed with the episode. I thought they did a good job. I was pretty interested in the character of Clovis as far as it goes. He's, you know, I like the politics and stuff that goes on in the prequel era. I really enjoy it. I like the banking clan and the commerce guild and the techno union and the trade federation. Like, I like all those things. Obviously, they're very on the nose what George Lucas is criticizing when he talks about those things.
Oh, yeah.
I was excited to learn more about it. And it's a shame that we have to wait until season 6 to really dive deeper into the banking clan and the moons and everything. But or the Muns, I should say. But I actually really like this episode. I mean, it's not, you know, my favorite episode or anything like that. But as far as what I thought was originally just a standalone episode, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it works really well. And kind of like you had said before, you know, drawing heavily from from the Hitchcock film Notorious really is what I think kind of helps it carry this more complicated story, especially in at this kind of still early point in the Clone Wars animated series. And I believe you'd said the final scenes kind of play out like almost shot for shot exactly the way that the film plays out, right?
Yep, correct. In the film, it pretty much ends the exact same way. So they've been poisoning the Nazi collaborator's mother is like a Nazi, you know, matriarch, basically. And she's been poisoning, and she poisons Ingrid Bergman's coffee, I think, is what happens. And she falls ill, and the character's name is Devlin, which is the Anakin equivalent in this, comes to get her and realizes that she's been poisoned and goes to take her away. And Sebastian, which is her ex-lover, which is the Clovis character in this, kind of covers her escape to allow them to get onto a transport ship to, you know, sail away. I don't think she needs an antidote in this. I think she just needs to like get away, and she's fine.
Needs to just stop being poisoned repeatedly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or go to a hospital or something like that. So it's like a transport truck is what it is. So they put her on a transport truck, and Sebastian, you know, begs to be able to go with Devlin, and Alicia are the good characters in this, but they contemptuously drive away. And there's all of his like Nazi friends are right behind him, and they say something along the lines of like, we need to talk, or like, Sebastian, we need to have a talk.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's pretty much the exact same way that this ends. So.
Fantastic. I really love the way that this all lines up, and I kind of love that it sort of secretly draws from a Hitchcock film, which, you know, then isn't even mentioned in the featurette. I don't think it's mentioned in the trivia on StarWars.com. It's sort of so well hidden that you would almost have to have seen that film. And it's an old film. So certainly there are people who are into movies like that, but it's not as common. It's going to be a much smaller audience that's going to be even aware of it. And even if you have seen it, you have to watch this and recognize that the plot plays out in the same way. So pretty wild. But that's the beauty of the internet, or the HoloNet, if you will. And did we mention already, this is the first time not live action, but in broadcast media that the HoloNet is mentioned.
Right.
Also
right.
Pretty
now,
wild.
I don't think we mentioned that, but yeah, so the HoloNet had been in the expanded universe for quite some time. And remember that this being season two was pre-Lucasfilm's acquisition by Disney, right? So this was back when they had tiers of canon, right? And the highest tier of canon was the movies, and this TV series were the highest tier of canon. This is the first time that the HoloNet got elevated into this tier of canon. Previously, it had kind of just been in books and novelizations and other such stuff. It actually first came about in 1989. It was in a role-playing game sourcebook is where the HoloNet was mentioned. The HoloNet, for those of you who are unaware, is kind of like a mixture of television and the internet for the Star Wars galaxy, right?
Yeah.
So you made a good joke before this that the reason they had 1,000 years apiece is because they didn't have the internet. And of course, as soon as they get the HoloNet introduced to the new canon, everything goes downhill, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of how it plays out. Sometimes that's what it feels like. How things are playing out in real life, rather depressingly. You know, I feel like a grumpy old man yelling at kids on my lawn saying that, but you know, as somebody who relies on the internet for his employment, I feel qualified to make that criticism. But kind of a,
you know, it's
go ahead. I was gonna say there's kind of a bunch of random trivia here before we dive into some of that other random trivia.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned earlier a bit of trivia that this is the first episode in the Clone Wars that we see where there's, you know, no shots fired, no explosions, no clone troopers. It's just like a very low-key episode. Well, hilariously, one of the bits of trivia about Notorious is that even though it's a spy thriller involving assassinations and attempts at assassinations, there's no physical violence shown on screen at all in that entire movie, which is pretty funny. So it's funny that the movie... And, you know, these mirror images between the two are just, they're absolutely excellent.
Yeah, well, you know, they did, you know, among other things that he was called a master of. Hitchcock was always called kind of the master of suspense and of that sort of that implied horror that is always so much worse than just showing something directly. And certainly, especially with the special effects at the time, you had to be a little more creative to really scare people or to get them to feel a certain way. And there's so much like near violence and implied violence that never comes to fruition in this episode. And I'm sure in the film as well, that, you know, especially as kind of a breather from the relentless war of the Clone Wars, it really stands out. And, you know, it does work, you know, as a breather, right? We take a breath from it, and we kind of join Anakin in that too here. I think he's sort of, you know, all we see him doing is fighting constantly. Gets this one reprieve, and unfortunately he's not really able to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And then what do? Next episode, we pick up with him going back to war. That's how it goes. But yeah, so some other fun trivia. I enjoy here that Anakin uses clicks as a unit of time, where clicks is normally used in Star Wars and in the real world as a measure of distance, being a short way to say kilometers. How long a click is in time is not entirely clear here. Mm-hmm. But I think it's funny because, of course, parsecs is used the same way in, you know, A New Hope when Han Solo describes the Millennium Falcon making a trip in less than 12 parsecs. It's implied there that they're using it as a unit of time, but it's actually a measure of distance. And
then they fix that in Solo, right?
Yeah.
Where they imply that he was able to take a shortcut, and so he actually did, you know, make the traversal in a shorter distance than most people physically can.
Right, exactly, yeah. Here, though, they're just like, nope, we're just using it as both distance and time. And, you know, in a galactic empire, time and space are very tightly intertwined. Of course, they're all traveling through hyperspace all the time, so...
Right.
Maybe it makes sense. I don't know. We'll hand wave it.
I mean, I think that's pretty much it as far as I've got. I think we called out most of the trivia during it. So I guess it's time to rate the episode. I mean,
yeah,
it ends a lot better than I was expecting it to. It's still not really one of my favorite episodes. I think as far as episodes go, it's a skippable episode, although I wouldn't recommend skipping it. I think it helps to build, like you said, I think it helps to build Anakin and Padme's relationship. It introduces Clovis Rush, who is an interesting character, if not a major character. But he will show up again later, right? So it helps to have seen him. I want to maybe give it like a 7.5. I think it's like a pretty, pretty average episode as far as it goes. I enjoyed the ending of it a lot more than I was expecting to. But I also kind of felt like the first, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, at least the first time I watched it, you know, on this rewatch, I was like, nah, you know, I was pretty ambivalent about it. So,
yeah, I'm going to say, you know, I enjoy this type of episode that sort of takes a break from the grain and shows us something different, which makes me want to rate it a bit higher and give it an 8. On the other hand, my daughter really doesn't enjoy this type of episode that has a whole bunch of romance and nothing exploding.
Yeah.
And I think she would probably rate it down for those reasons. So I'm going to split the difference and call it a 7.5 from the Kutch household as a whole and say that's fair. I know IMDb puts it at currently at a 6.9 out of 10. So I feel like we're coming in about where we usually do, which is a bit higher than IMDb.
Yeah, I think we're almost always like a half point to a point higher than IMDb in general. But yeah, I mean, it's not a bad episode by any stretch of the imagination. Like, I definitely couldn't rate it any lower.
Right.
I could conceivably rate it higher, but like, there are just so many other good episodes that are like, you know, thrilling and entertaining. And like, I dig the politics stuff. I really do. I think I probably like that more than the average viewer does. And certainly more than your daughter does. But especially compared to the next few episodes that we're going to get, like those episodes to me are like really, really classic Clone Wars, right? Like,
yeah,
this is the third time I've seen this. I watched this episode twice before and literally couldn't remember anything about it, you know? So
yeah, I will say it's, you know, it's not the politics, I think, that bothers the kiddo so much as people kissing being implied. You know, she's still at an age where it's just like, you know, like gross, skip.
Well, hey, you know, at least it wasn't. So this is where it does differ from Notorious. In Notorious, she actually marries the guy.
Oh, wow.
And like, yeah. And like, it takes place over an extended period of time. She actually like marries him, goes on a honeymoon with him. Like, they actually have sex. So it's like, well, you know, could have been worse.
Being a film as opposed to a 20-minute episode. Yeah, you can see where they spend a little more time building that up.
Right.
And obviously, being Star Wars, I think a lot of things being left unsaid off screen or just not happening at all. Probably, yeah, for the best.
It might have been a bridge too far for Padme to actually hook up with Clovis compared to.
I think that would have been too far. So anyways, that leaves us with the end of Senate Spy. A fine Clone Wars episode, if not an outstanding one. I think, though, it does foreshadow more intrigue in seasons to come, which only get better and better.
Yep. And then let's see. So later on next week, well, I'm not sure when we're going to record next week because I'm going to be out of town on the weekend. So it might be a weeknight recording.
Same.
But we've got Landing at Point Rain and Weapons Factory, if you're keeping up with us. So now I've learned that this is the Geonosian Weapons Factory that they learned about from Clovis that they're going to attack. And these two episodes then lead into Legacy of Terror and Brain Invaders, which are two of my favorite episodes from early Clone Wars. So very much looking forward to those. But we also, you know, next week we get Barriss Offee.
Yeah.
Right? So I hope everyone's excited about that. I think that's her first introduction in Clone Wars.
Yeah, and she's had quite the year with Tales of the Jedi. So be fun to kind of go back to the beginning, to the first portrayal, and see where it all began once more.
Yep. All right, guys. Well, that's it for us. So I guess we'll see you next week.
All right. Until then, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.